This week on Vaticano, discover the story of Blessed Edward Profitli from Estonia. Attend the Benedict XVI Forum in Hamburg, Germany, and hear the unique insights from Gianfranco Zwiderkowski, the only living journalist who heard the sessions of the Second Vatican Council in the Vatican. For this and more, Vaticano starts now. Estonia is among the most secular nations in Europe, yet in recent years, its Catholic community has quietly grown. Much of this renewed faith is linked to the country's first blessed, Blessed Edward Profitlik. Born in Germany, Profitlik became apostolic administrator of Estonia. During the Soviet occupation, he refused to flee, saying a shepherd must share the fate of his flock. His courage led to his arrest and death in a Soviet prison in 1942. On October the 24th, an Estonian delegation visited the Vatican for a private audience with Pope Leo XIV, carrying with them the memory and legacy of Blessed Profitlik. Bishop Philippe Jean-Charles Jordan, who led the group, recalled one of the most moving moments of the meeting.
He spoke also about ecumenism, because there was among us also a strong group of people who are in great part Lutherans, and some of them without religion, but people who helped for the organization of the beatification of Archbishop Profitlich. And so the Pope said that your ecumenical relation is the best medicine against hatred.
What once seemed to divide the nation now appears to have become the foundation for a new beginning of national unity.
The saints divided us in the time of the Lutheran Reformation, the 16th century, and now really I felt that the saints have the potential to unite again Catholics and Lutherans. And then the fact also that Profitlich, by the way he died, is a symbol. In every family, there were victims like that. Not everybody for the name of Christ, but it's a symbol of the trauma suffered by the Estonian people in the Soviet time. And not only Estonian, but also the Russians living in Estonia.
The national census indicates that the share of Catholics in Estonia has doubled, rising from 0.4% in 2011 to 0.8% in 2021. Bishop Jordan notes that there's still much to be done, reminding that no effort is too small when it comes to guiding even one person towards the faith.
We can have a lot of people who ask to be baptized, and thanks to God, I think that in Northern Europe, now there is really many young people coming for baptism, but if you don't form them, it's like, putting seeds, but without water, without soil, it doesn't really grow up. But in the case of Estonia, it's a vital necessity because there are no traditional Catholics in our country. And so it's work with each one of them.
On November the 6th and 7th, experts in artificial intelligence, technology companies, and investors gathered at the Pontifical Gregorian University for the Builders AI Forum. The event promoted the development of AI as a means to serve the Catholic Church's mission, especially in education, healthcare, media, and evangelization.
You also have a lot of speakers or participants here from the tech world, Microsoft, HP, other companies who sent people or where people are interested in engaging also with the church. Why is that?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. I think the companies, they see an opportunity to serve an important market. I mean, there's a lot of Catholics in the world, and they feel their tech platforms could be helpful in servicing that mission. But I think beyond that, I think a lot of the companies, especially the AI labs, are aware that as these AIs become more and more intelligent, they become more and more powerful, the more we have them acting agentically in the world, they need to have some kind of understanding philosophically, right? They need to have some kind of moral code which guides them.
Participants took part in various workshops where they discussed possible applications of artificial intelligence and the ethical boundaries that would allow designers to safeguard human dignity while offering tools focused on real human needs. Sean Graber, president of EWTN Digital, also participated in the conference and shared his insights on the role of AI in today's world.
Well, it plays a huge role. I mean, AI is just taking the world by storm, and you know, it's enabling us to do a lot of things that we couldn't do before. So we're experimenting with how to use AI in some light ways in content creation, in sort of brainstorming the way that we evangelize and tell stories, and then even in more prosaic ways, you know, how we develop software, how we build apps, how we market and tell the story of our own products and bring those to the world.
Pope Leo XIV sent a message to the participants in the forum expressing his gratitude to all those working to ensure that emerging technologies remain oriented toward the dignity of the human person and the common good.
Catholics need to be in the mix, they need to be involved, and taking risks, if you like, to be creative. Otherwise, we'll just get left behind and we'll be playing catch-up.
Would you say that it's necessary to have also gatherings like this, let's say inside the church, to learn more about those new technologies?
We try to use all these things available for us for the right reason and right purpose as well.
Coming right up, join us for the first Benedict XVI Forum in Hamburg, Germany, honoring the legacy of the late Pope.
Cari fratelli cardinali,
on April the 18th, 2005, German Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger gave a widely noted sermon in St. Peter's Basilica. It was shortly after the death of John Paul II, and no one could have known that Ratzinger would be elected Pope the very next day.
Today, having a clear faith based on the creed of the Church is often labeled as fundamentalism, whereas relativism, that is, letting oneself be tossed here and there, carried about by every wind of doctrine, seems the only attitude that can cope with modern times. We are building a dictatorship of relativism that does not recognize anything as definitive and whose ultimate goal consists solely of one's own ego and desires.
20 years after Pope Benedict XVI's leadership of the Church, his warning about the dictatorship of relativism appears to have been, at least in part, fulfilled.
Today, there is a very strong tendency to be intolerant in the name of tolerance if one does not hold the opinion that is expected. That is why it is liberating to search for the truth in all openness, honesty, and freedom.
That is indeed a major problem. If there is no truth in a society, then there is also no inviolable human dignity. That is why it is important to talk about this issue, and that is what we are trying to do here in Hamburg.
From November the 7th to the 9th, 2025, the German association Fundatio Christiana Virtus organized a Benedict XVI Forum in Hamburg, Germany, a theological conference on the theme, Truth as a Challenge for the Church and Society. In northern Germany, only about 10% of the population is baptized Catholic. Nevertheless, many young people came to the Benedict Forum to learn more about the theology of the man who chose as his motto the title, Co-Worker of the Truth.
Die Wahrheit bleibt immer attraktiv.
The truth always remains attractive. Pope Benedict XVI has repeatedly pointed this out. This seems to exert a new appeal, especially for people who are serious, who really want to follow the path of faith, and who have an inner sensitivity that there is more to life than the here and now.
Ich brauche gerade hier Hinweise.
The speakers also included high-ranking experts from the Vatican.
Ja, bei mir geht's um Gesellschaft und Politik.
My lecture is about society and politics. Church and state are separate, but according to Pope Benedict and Catholic tradition, the church has a duty to remind the state that there are non-negotiable principles that take precedence over legislation and cannot be overridden by majority decisions.
Entscheidungen außer Kraft gesetzt werden können.
In der Öffentlichkeit den Anspruch erheben.
I believe we need to rediscover that every person has their own views and convictions, but that the truth cannot be divided. The truth is a shared truth. Otherwise, any dialogue would be difficult.
In the past, the Benedict Forum took place in the Bavarian shrine of Altötting in southern Germany. Now the organizers ventured all the way north to Hamburg, Germany's second largest city, right in the heart of the German diaspora. The Archbishop of Hamburg was very grateful for this.
It is important for believers in the diaspora to meet each other and strengthen each other in their faith. That's why I'm grateful that they came up with the idea of trying it out here with the Benedict Forum, and it seems to have been quite successful.
We have now received many requests to set up similar Benedict forums in other places, even in America and other countries. So word seems to be spreading slowly that Pope Benedict really has something to say to people.
In addition to theological lectures by Cardinal Koch, Professor Rolf Weimann, Professor Thomas Marschler, and Professor Markus Graulich, former companions of Pope Benedict XVI also shared very personal insights into the life of the late Pope. Thorsten Weber, a native of Hamburg, had once given up his career as a radio journalist after Pope Benedict XVI's writings had awakened in him the desire to convert to Catholicism and ultimately to the priesthood. After his ordination as a deacon, he met the then emeritus Pope in Rome.
Und damals war ich ja Diakon in Mecklenburg.
At that time, I was a deacon in northern Germany, and when I told him that, he asked me, "Are there still Catholics there?" I replied, "With great joy, Holy Father, but they are a little scattered." And then he said, "Then hold high the banner of the Holy Spirit there," that the mission he gave to me, and I have been striving to fulfill it ever since.
During the 1960s, Father Martin Trimpe worked for Professor Joseph Ratzinger. After suffering from a spiritual crisis, it's thanks to the example set by his professor that Trimpe discovered his faith and ultimately his calling to the priesthood.
Did Ratzinger change after his election as Pope Benedict XVI?
Ja, ist noch durchsichtiger geworden auf den Herrn.
Yes, he became even more transparent in his devotion to the Lord. He was always modest, and Christ always spoke through him, if I may put it so grandly. But as Pope, he became even more transparent.
And so, in keeping with Pope Benedict's spirit, the Benedict XVI Forum is not only about talking about God, but also talking with God. The organizers and participants are certain that this concept is a way to keep the Pope's legacy alive.
Oh, yeah, das war sein Lebenselixier.
Oh, yes, Benedict would be delighted. That was his lifeblood. When it came to talking to other people, when it came to the truth, he was immediately alert and willing to make any personal sacrifice.
I truly believe that we will reach the point where he will be declared a doctor of the church, and I hope so too.
You heard it here first on EWTN.
60 years ago, on December the 8th, 1965, the Catholic Church closed the doors to the public for a historic gathering, the Second Vatican Council. For almost 4 years, bishops and theologians debated how the Church could speak to a rapidly changing world. At only 25 years old, Gianfranco Zwiderkowski found himself at the heart of one of the Church's greatest events, experiencing the Council up close. Today, he remains one of the few eyewitnesses who can share his first-hand experience.
It was truly something new, something incredible. 2,500 bishops walking across St. Peter's Square and entering St. Peter's Basilica, and you could really grasp the universality of the Church. I must say, honestly, that the real Council began that evening, on the same day, October 12, 1962, because it was the Church speaking once again the language of the people, not the lofty, theological, philosophical language that the Church had used for so many centuries. It was the language of ordinary people. John XXIII said, "Look at the moon up there in the sky. It has come to visit us." And then he spoke about hardships, about people who weep. And he said, "Go back home and give your children a kiss and a caress." And I went back home and caressed my one-year-old son.
You have to confess where you were when the council began.
That morning, when the council's work opened, I, being curious, went ahead to have a look, to exchange a few words. But then they declared extra omnes, meaning all outsiders had to leave. And I found myself, despite running, stuck halfway inside the basilica. I didn't know where to go, and I could feel the gaze of two gendarmes who seemed ready to take action. So, as soon as I found an opening, I slipped away and hid inside a confessional. And there, inside that confessional, the only journalist in the world, I listened to the first debate, which was very heated, especially from the French and German bishops. They demanded that the conciliar commissions not be formed in the same way as the preparatory commissions, which had been made up entirely of curia members. Instead, they wanted the same group of cardinals and bishops to be the ones appointing those members.
Incredible, even as a personal experience. And speaking of those 2,500 council fathers, I'm curious if you can identify or single out anyone, any figure, who already seemed like a prominent figure of the era.
For example, Swenens, who at the end of the first session suggested how to shape the council, distinguishing between church ad intra, the church in itself, and church ad extra, the church in its relationship with the world, which would later become the two constitutions, De Ecclesia and Gaudium et Spes.
The change of the council itself, but also the change of the church.
The church changed because the church, as an institution, was no longer what it had been before. The Bible returned once again into the hands of the people, something that never had happened before. There was the liturgical reform. The church opened itself to the world with Gaudium et Spes, which addressed all the problems concerning the lives of men and women, life, family, justice, and also peace and war. After 2,000 years, the church was saying that the Jewish people of both yesterday and today were not responsible for the death of Jesus. Today, with what is happening in the Middle East, I cannot reconcile these two religions, Judaism and Islam, with the same spiritual originality that existed back then. This is what the council provoked and created. How for some reason it did not move forward, and how it is now necessary to recover what was the foundation of the council.
So there is still work to be done?
Certainly, yes. Because the very fact, for example, within the church, the relationship between primacy of the Pope and episcopal collegiality has still not been clearly defined.
Exactly. And if it hasn't been done yet, do you think it might be time to convene another event of such magnitude in the church?
To convene one, perhaps not. Also because Francis has already opened many of these issues, but being a typical Jesuit, he has never fully brought them to completion. But he himself says that problems must be opened without necessarily resolving them. And now this Pope finds himself having to deal with a church situation in which some issues need to be picked up and brought to completion, while others perhaps should not be addressed, but set aside.
Grazie.
Thank you for this wonderful time you've shared with us.
Thank you.
Don't go away. Explore the powerful story of St. Thérèse of Lisieux and her lasting impact. In the heart of Normandy, France, in 1873, a child was born who would become one of the most beloved saints in the world, Thérèse Martin. Her life was short, only 24 years, but her soul was immense, capable of illuminating millions of believers with her little way, the way of love and simplicity. Thérèse grew up in a deeply Christian family. Her parents, Louis and Zélie Martin, also canonized, passed on to her a living and concrete faith. Yet her life was not easy. She lost her mother at only 4 years old and began to suffer from a mysterious illness. Father François Lethel, a Carmelite priest and expert on St. Thérèse of Lisieux's life, explains how she, even as a child, felt called to belong entirely to God.
She shows a truly splendid interior journey. At the age of 10, she had a very serious illness, psychological and psychosomatic, and she was healed by the smile of the Virgin Mary, that is, by the experience of Mary's maternal love. And especially at 14, what she calls her Christmas conversion, she describes it beautifully. She was freed from her hypersensitivity, from a certain childishness, and begins what she calls a giant's race towards God.
Thérèse was determined to enter the Carmelite convent, but she was still too young. At age 14, she made her one and only pilgrimage to Rome. During her stay, she prayed in the Church of Trinità dei Monti, where her relics are now displayed for the 2025 Jubilee year. Father Fabrice Duhayes tells us about her special connection to this place.
She went with her father here in Rome to ask the Pope the possibility to enter in the convent. And when she stayed in Rome, she stayed 300 meters away from here in a small hotel. If you go in the street, you can see it still written that St. Thérèse stayed in this place when she was in Rome. And she came frequently at the chapel Mater Admirabilis to pray during her stay here in Rome. Seeing this picture of the Virgin Mary, which is painted as a teenager, is probably a great help for her to pray.
When she was finally presented to Pope Leo XIII, Thérèse knelt before him in tears, asking permission to enter the convent. The Pope told her to trust and follow the guidance of her superiors. Sister Antonella Piccirilli, professor of theology at the Theresianum, explains how Thérèse lived this disappointment.
When she recounts that the Pope did not give her explicit permission, she writes, "I had already offered myself to Jesus, to be his joy, his little toy, his ball. And on that day," she says, "Jesus pierced the ball." This image seems playful, but it expresses a deep pain. A punctured ball is thrown away, is useless. Thérèse felt useless in the hands of God, yet she made even this her joy, because her joy was to delight God.
Upon her return to Rome, Thérèse obtained permission from Bishop Flavien Hugonin to enter the Carmelite convent at 15 years of age.
She is very close to St. Francis of Assisi. The evangelical poverty of Francis and the evangelical littleness of Thérèse are the same thing, the littleness of Jesus himself, God who becomes small.
In 1897, weakened by tuberculosis, she died at only 24 years of age. In her final months, she endured a profound spiritual trial known as the Night of Faith, but she faced her suffering with serenity.
Her last 18 months were complete darkness. She says, "For me, faith has become a wall reaching to the sky." Yet her greatness is in her unwavering trust. Suffering can distance or embitter, but for Therese it became a privileged path to encounter God.
È una pista privilegiata per l'incontro con Dio.
Her death wasn't an end, but a beginning. Therese promised, "After my death, I will let fall a shower of roses." She meant the graces and miracles she would obtain from heaven. In 1925, Pope Pius XI declared her a saint. In 1997, exactly 100 years after her death, Pope John Paul II proclaimed her a Doctor of the Church, a title reserved for the great masters of the faith.
Papa Francesco la chiama Dottore della Sintesi.
Pope Francis calls her the Doctor of Synthesis. In her writings, she expresses all the truths of the Catholic faith: Jesus, the Trinity, Mary, the Church, the Eucharist, clearly and beautifully.
La verità che risplende della.
In a world dominated by efficiency, visibility, and measurable results, Saint Therese of Lisieux reminds us that holiness is not reserved for heroes or extraordinary mystics, but is within the reach of everyone.